Blog Talk Radio.
Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, spiritual relationship healing expert, helping men and women heal their bodies, their relationships, and their lives through love. Author of the book, Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me, director of HealthyBabyBoomersNetwork.com, and creator of the Healing Through Love seminar series, available at budurl.com/8audioseminar. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter how old you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who are proving that life can, and often does, get better and better as we reach our 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. Today I have the privilege and delight of speaking with Dr. Peter Zafiridis, a multifaceted medical doctor with a true understanding of the mind-body connection and how we can truly heal our body through our mind, and our mind through our body. Dr. Zafiridis is president of Central Ohio Behavioral Medicine Incorporated, COBMI, established in 1997. COBMI is a premier behavioral healthcare practice composed of a multidisciplinary group of medical, nursing, and counseling professionals. Dr. Zafiridis is also a clinical assistant professor at Ohio State University's Department of Psychiatry, where he regularly teaches first and second year medical students at the College of Medicine, and he is often a guest lecturer of psychopharmacology for graduate students enrolled in the counselor education program. His area of interest within psychiatry is the mind-body role of emotions in physical illness, specifically chronic pain, which so many of us have. Since 1997, he has given over 1,000 lectures to both professional and public audiences on many aspects of human behavior, including emotional illness, psychopharmacology, the mind-body role of emotions in physical illness, human motivation, and the psychology of influence. He's been published in this area of psychiatry, and he also sits on the board of directors of the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association, and now he hosts the Healthy Mind weekly radio broadcast. So I'm really excited to be speaking with Dr. Peter. Hello?
Hi, Erica. Thank you so much. What a wonderful introduction. Wow.
Well, you've done so much.
My gosh, my mom would be so proud.
Well, I imagine as a psychiatrist in the medical profession dealing with the mind-body connection, you know, may have brought some difficulties or some controversy. So I'd love to hear about your background, training, experience, like what led you to this whole area and then to creating the Healthy Mind.
Yes, wow, well, thank you. Sure. You know, I've always been interested in psychiatry, certainly in college and in my training in undergrad. That was an interest, and I've always known I've wanted to go into medicine, but I didn't think that I would be a psychiatrist when I started medical school, but it just spoke to me, and that's where I had gone through my residency and training. But within psychiatry, I'd always had this interest in the overlap of physical pain and mood. and saw quite a few individuals even back then, both in terms of benign pain, just typical pain that we have, and malignant pain, those who might be suffering with cancer. And really, just in going through the years of my practice, it seems like the mind-body movement has certainly come to the forefront now, and I just evolved along with it. You know, some of my early influences were both Irving Yalom with existential psychotherapy that I was trained in, and also the work of Dr. John Sarno with the mind-body connection and physical pain. So over the years, I've blended it in my way to utilize some of what I've learned within therapy to help those individuals who may be manifesting some of their emotional symptoms in physical pain. And, you know, that's typically what I do in my practice. And also about half a year ago now, I had started the Healthy Mind website just with the purpose of letting people know what's out there in terms of the information, trying to reduce some of the stigma of when we talk about mind and body together, that people don't think that it's a weakness or some kind of flaw in character because their emotions are involved here. And that's kind of where that interest and inspiration from those that I treat in terms of their strength kind of led me to the Healthy Mind. So that's just kind of a thumbnail sketch of me a little bit.
And you said it's only been about 6 months. You have so many wonderful articles up there in a short period of time.
Well, thank you. Yes, it's just incredible information that's out there. It's been fortunate. People have been supporting the site by visiting it as well. And, you know, I've just really enjoyed doing it. You know, it's just, I'm sure, like the things that you do both in your therapy and also the wonderful broadcast that you have. When you love what you're doing, it's easy to do, or easier to do, let's say.
One of the things that I really value about what you're doing is that a lot of this information is held within the professional organizations, and the colleagues talk amongst themselves, or they write for the journals, and it's not always put out for the public in a way that people, the average person, can understand.
Yes, that's true, and there's always a little bit that's always, it's hard and lost in translation when you have more on the level of scientific journals versus in digestible forms that people can understand. It's one thing to have the research knowledge, but then how do people know about it and then are able to apply it? So it's nice to be able to be doing that, certainly with the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association group that we have formed, that will be part of the mission there to get the information out about this mind-body connection and let people know here are individuals either throughout the country or in your neighborhood, excuse me, that would be able to explain this and help you through this, because it's real. It's real. And we just have to have people start to feel comfortable with that.
Well, what's interesting is that I was on the original steering committee for the U.S. Association for Body Psychotherapy, and that,
is that
brought
right?
together all the leading people in the fields of body therapy and somatic therapies and people combining touch with counseling. It brought all of them together, and that organization, I was on the board for several years, and I'm still involved with them, and but it is not involving the medical profession. It's the counseling and body therapy professions. So you're bridging a gap there that's so needed.
Well, we're trying to. I think that the early work by, you know, Dr. Sarno and others, there have been many who have contributed to the field, but Dr. Sarno is perhaps the most well-known in that regard of the physicians, really has helped.
So maybe, as there are two people, I'd like you to explain their work. Dr. Sarno that you mentioned and Dr. Yalom, so maybe
yes.
You can explain the concepts and the type of work that led to what you're doing now.
Sure. No, thank you. With Dr. Yalom, probably one of the more famous psychiatrists and writers out there, his theory, which he expanded on and formally introduced, kind of this existential psychotherapy that has spoken to me. The idea that a lot of our behavior comes from issues that are part of the human condition. They're not necessarily due to maladaptive or problematic patterns of our adjustment. Issues of meaning, of our mortality, of our purpose, of our isolation, our aloneness, if you will, and that these are the forces that dictate how we behave, both in a healthy way and in an unhealthy way. And that really spoke to me in terms of understanding it, perhaps on a level. It just spoke to me, and I've always been keen to that type of therapy, and where I had gotten some extra guidance during my residency and beyond. And with Dr. Sarno, his work had stated that emotions themselves, this is talking about physical symptoms that are present in an individual pain, and he's expanded it over the years to other physical symptoms, but principally pain, when it occurs, and there's no good reason why it should be happening on a physical level. Tests are coming up negative, MRIs are clean, CAT scans are clean, where the doctors are saying, we have no idea why you're in this much pain. He brought forth a theory that talked about the role of emotions and how our mind will utilize physical pain as a means by which to protect us from some of these emotions. So the pain itself isn't, let's say, neurotic or something that is coming from that we're making up in our mind or hypochondriac, but it is, there's an express purpose for this physical pain. And to me, I try to bridge both understanding why this happens from the existential perspective, but also utilizing the theories of Dr. Sarno and what he had initially called TMS, or tension myositis syndrome. And that's what our group, at least with the PPDA, is hoping to do in the years to come, is, with respect, move his theories a bit more forward and advocate for this mind-body connection, because it just seems the time is right. So many people are realizing that strictly the medical part of Western medicine, it's an important part, but oftentimes doesn't explain the entirety of the human being in a holistic way. We've always got to be careful in medicine that we're not chopping it down to these little parts, these little symptoms, before we look at the whole.
Well, there are many other cultures that have a long history of understanding the mind-body connection, like Chinese medical theory and Shiatsu and acupressure theory and Indian Ayurvedic theory. All of those combine some aspect, and also chakras. There are meridians and chakras, and they have connection to the organs and to the emotions involved with that part of the body and those organs.
Yes.
So it's been known for centuries, but Western medicine is finally beginning to recognize it again.
Absolutely. And I think that, again, not to diminish anything from Western medicine, there have been huge advances and continue to be, both in the physical and in the emotional, the psychological. But I think just within that, though, we have to have the humility that Western medicine doesn't always explain everything. And people don't respond just to the medical treatment only. It is important in terms of the psychological, whether it is meditation or any of these other types of practices. These help people. Their lives are better. They feel better and physically respond. We have to recognize that and be willing in medicine to say, this happens, and let's not push it away, but let's embrace it together in getting the total health of the individual. And I think that's starting to happen. I mean, one of the biggest growing fields within at least medicine is this integrative health model, where it isn't just about the pharmacotherapy or the medical treatment, but all aspects of health are looked at. Many of the practices that you just spoke of are utilized in the entire plan of helping an individual.
Yeah, I would like to say something about that, that I really tend not to want to take medication, not to really want to go to medical doctors, because I'm not always trusting what they're going to tell me to do. However, when I hurt my back and I was lying on the floor, this was many years ago, and I couldn't move, when I finally got up and got in my car and got to the emergency room, I was never so happy to take medicine. So, that was one example.
Sure.
And about 2 months ago, I was playing tennis and I walked and stepped on a tennis ball and heard a loud crack in my ankle. And that's another time when I was never so happy to get to a doctor, where he evaluated it, he took the x-rays or the MRI, whatever he had to take, and put a cast on, and it's 100% better.
Yeah, so. You know, we have to realize that, and I always tell people, particularly when they're coming in for, you know, for treatment, maybe for, you know, anxiety and depression, and I think it's a healthy way of looking at it. Realize people are going to be skeptical, and I you know, I would encourage that in those who do any type of have any intervention with their doctors, and make sure that you understand exactly why the treatment is what it is. Ask questions, advocate for your health. But in that same vein, it's also realize that for some part of the overall treatment, medications may be helpful. And I think that that is a comfortable place. It doesn't mean that one has to accept that the only treatments are the medical treatments or medications, but that not in a way to marginalize them where they don't work at all. I think that's just being a bit unfair. And, you know, in some cases, you know, may hurt an individual to keep that type of perspective.
That's absolutely true. And
yeah.
And even with counseling and psychiatry, sometimes, you know, it's better to have some medication to calm the person down so they can get emotional treatment.
I think that's very true. But, you know, there's, even within psychiatry, it's important that, you know, what really is the healing aspect? Is it really the fact that I give a person an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety agent, or I sit down with them face-to-face, take the time, and reassure them that it's going to be okay. We are going to figure this out, that I'm with you in this journey until we get this taken care of. How much of that is involved in the healing response? And I have to believe that that's a significant part as well. Not to minimize the effect of the medications, but it's never about just one part. And I always emphasize with those that I see, the medications should never be seen as the whole. They're a very, very small part. What you do, what you learn about yourself, how you grow is the reason that you will begin to get better and move towards health.
Yeah, and what you believe, a person's brain,
absolutely,
what they're thinking is so powerful.
Absolutely. So, that cannot be underestimated, or overstated, rather.
So you have... you mentioned something, and I'd like to understand what that is. Can you tell us more about TMS and PPD? I don't know what those are.
Sure, sure. In TMS, it is the theories that Dr. Sarno had brought out, the tension myositis syndrome, TMS. And PPD is something our group has put together, the psychophysiologic disorders. The theories are, or the principles are the same. How much distress, emotion, impact directly on our physical. Now, during Dr. Sarno's work, he's about to retire, literally tomorrow is his last day of practice, he had found, and his theories were, that in response to an emotion, anger, rage, that our bodies will move through a physiologic pathway or a process, a biological process, in which they create pain. Now, why on earth would the body want to create pain? And the theory is that these emotions, the threat of those coming to the surface and being expressed, this isn't just everyday emotion, anger and frustration, but these deeper emotions of anger and rage are so threatening to the individual that the mind will move down this pathway to protect the body in general, because it is a greater threat to release the emotion than to have the physical. But make no mistake, the physical pain is real. This isn't something that the brain makes up and you think you have pain. It's real pain. The process that he felt it was going through was that there might be a change in blood supply of oxygen to tissues. For example, if I embarrassed you right now, you'd flush red in a second. You haven't moved a muscle, nothing's happened.
But I would say something else also happens from my experience with body therapy and Alexander technique and Feldenkrais movements, is that if you get embarrassed or hurt in some way, there's a part of you that just tightens, like an instant tightening, and that could definitely affect blood flow.
Yes, it's exactly along the same lines. And again, we don't know these theories for sure, but the principle being that our emotions will do that. You know, when we get stressed, our stomach starts to hurt. We feel nauseous. When we get nervous, our heart tends to race. Maybe our mouth dries. We might get sweating in our palms and what have you. So it isn't that hard to understand where an emotion can cause a physical process. And what Dr. Sarno said was that there is, and you see this in, as you begin to see patients over a period of time, a very consistent type of profile of people coming in, tend to be the good kids, tend to avoid conflict, not want to cause problems. They might be very, very hardworking and driving. And in that perfectionistic, if you will, there tends to be the tendency to have some of these physical symptoms. Why? If you've got some of those tendencies within you, every time you've kind of wanted to be the good person or not cause trouble, there's part of you also that has said, man, this isn't fair. But yet you don't let that come to the surface. And any time that tends to bubble up, the mind then will do what it needs to protect the individual. This is a protective process. It isn't something that is hypochondriacal or something that is neurotic. It is a protection-based mechanism and should be understood in that way.
And what's interesting is that there's recent research, that people who have had some kind of abuse in childhood are more likely to have some of these chronic pain issues later on in life.
Yeah, that's correct. And this research is brand new and is really amazing to see. The other day, about a week or two ago, the relationship between childhood abuse and a greater likelihood of irritable bowel syndrome in adulthood. A couple days ago, childhood abuse and a threefold increase in the risk of schizophrenia. So the fact that these psychological abuses, emotional abuses in childhood, we're starting to understand almost in a physiologic or biological way how this is starting to affect the body. So really, this is where science is helping bridge some of that gap to say, wow, there really is a connection here to the mind-body. It's fascinating, and it seems like the research is moving at a fever pitch along this line.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question. Have you run into any challenges in your role as a physician and a psychiatrist, you know, among your colleagues at organizations, in thinking this way and knowing about the mind-body connection?
Well, yeah, no. Yes, I have. I mean, you know, first off, in psychiatry in general, I think if you're going to be a psychiatrist or someone in the mental health field, you just have to realize that there's always going to be some of that skepticism and stigma and stereotype that is there. But I think that's part of the reason why I became a psychiatrist, because I rather like that. Let me try and prove to you or show you that it isn't necessarily what you think. So, yes, there's a lot of stigma and resistance. I think it's changing. It's slightly changing. Doctors tend to be, you know, very committed to, you know, the way that they think, and oftentimes these things will be dismissed. But you're starting to see it. You see it indirectly by the amount of integrative physicians that are there. You see it by the increased prevalence of all different types of holistic types of treatments that are there. You know, we see that while Western medicine traditionally, as it's been, is helpful, it by no means is all as we regard and consider our health. And I think it's starting to shift, and, you know, doctors have to realize that, or else, you know, they're going to be left behind.
And a lot of patients are starting to resist traditional medical treatments. They've done statistics about how many people use alternative methods, you know, explore different alternative methods, and it keeps increasing.
Yes, and I think, you know, as long as individuals are looking and not necessarily denying maybe a treatment that is that could be helpful by traditional medicine, that we're not here to, you know, just kind of dismiss all of Western medicine. But in that, I think what should be done is an embracement of the entire person and the entire level of care. Part of that involves traditional medicine, but part of it also doesn't. And we have to be okay with that, both from a provider end, myself as a physician and most of us in the health field, but also in those that come to see us, that, you know, this isn't all. And let's take a look at some other possibilities as to why you might be feeling as bad as you are.
Mm-hmm. Really great. So I know that you're writing a chapter right now about existential psychotherapy. So maybe would you like to talk a little bit about what you're saying?
Yes, yes. Appreciate that. Yes, I am doing a chapter for a book that will be coming out in the next, maybe next year or so, a group of individuals from a few of the universities here in town entitled The Psychology of Meaning. And some beautiful, beautiful theories that are being put out in terms of how we just understand ourselves and put meaning in our lives. And my chapter will be specifically in terms of how some of these ideas, particularly along the existential perspective, are applied in therapy. How do we use some of these ideas with regards to meaning and purpose in a clinical setting to help individuals in therapy. So I'm going through some of the history of the field and then also preparing some case examples for that as well. So I'm really excited about it. It's been a fun project to do.
One of the things that I find really important in people's lives is living their passion, finding their purpose and their passion, and then pursuing it. And that can make a huge difference in someone's physical health and emotional health.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I think oftentimes our psychological health and our physical health can be a bit of a weather vane, a little bit of a signal. If we're not on the right track on all aspects of our lives, our bodies know. And they're going to react both directly in terms of how we are feeling. We feel anxious, we feel disillusioned, we may feel depressed, and we, you know, may also feel the physical symptoms that are present as well. But there's a lot of hope there as people find what is right for them, find their meaning, find their purpose, follow their passion. It isn't just about doing that, but you get rewards both in the way that you feel emotionally and in the way that you feel physically. And all of us have experienced that both personally, and I certainly see that in those that I care for. I'm sure you've seen that in your practice countless of times.
So that's true about pursuing your passion. And then I've looked at some of your articles on your website, and one of them in particular was interesting, where you wrote that thinking about death can lead to a healthier life. So maybe you can talk more about that. That's an unusual way of thinking.
Yeah, it was a fascinating piece of research that was done, I believe, out of the University of Missouri. And the researchers there took a look at all the data that's out there and wanted to look at it to say, look, there's a lot of work that's been out there in terms of the problems with thinking about death too much and how that negatively impacts, but are there positive aspects to this as well? And really, it falls along this existentialist end. You know, a lot of times when I talk to my patients or other individuals about some of these existential principles, I say, God, this is so depressing. You know, what's the purpose of our life or the ideas about our death or our aloneness? But it's the other part, too. When we think about our mortality, when we think about our purpose and the fact that maybe we are alone, that can motivate us. We see how small a sliver of time that we have, and it can help to realign our priorities and motivate us to do things. And this is exactly what this particular study looked at and found. I mean, and in the article, it talked about multiple studies as sublime as how close you are to walking by a cemetery will impact how kind or not you are to others. But in the sense of increasing positive health behaviors, having an awareness of our mortality means that you watch what you eat. You watch your smoking, your drinking. You're more careful and vigilant about your health, and that allows you to live better and live longer. And that's what the study looked at. You know, oftentimes death itself, that subject, seems so heavy, but it's often a motivating principle in our lives. The reason that we do everything is because we've got a finite time, and we don't have to be so scared about thinking about that, because it also motivates us and allows us to really, you know, experience life and the moment, rather than being so caught up in our worries of the past or our anxieties about the future.
Very interesting. I've also discovered something recently. There's a site called Pinterest.com where you create
yes.
these boards and put pictures up. And I was
yes.
really enjoying looking at pictures of beautiful places around the world. And then I found some videos of animals around the world, nature and animals, enjoying life in the ocean and in the wild. And I was enjoying it very much, and it puts you in a sense that I'm just this small being, and they enjoy each moment, even though they have dangers, all of that. And then I saw a study saying that if you're out in nature for even 10 minutes a day, it helps you to concentrate better. It affects your mood.
Yes.
So a lot of this is beginning to make sense.
Oh, sure. I mean, it speaks to the heart of mindfulness. And, you know, people wonder, well, what is this mindfulness about? Why is it so important to be in the moment? And I always say, think about anything that's meaningful in your life, the best times that you've had, whether it's a particular event, a marriage, a wedding, birth of a child, a vacation. Those times mean the most to us because we're fully present in the moment. We've cast away anything that we have to worry about or anything that's happened to us, and we've immersed ourselves in the moment. And we derive health from that, and meaning and purpose. Those are the direct benefits of mindfulness and learning how to be in the moment, because that's where we are at our healthiest.
So another one of your articles says that positive feelings can decrease the risk of heart disease.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, it's an interesting thing to look at in terms of why would positive feelings impact the physical in that way. And really, this cuts really to the heart of at least a cutting edge of understanding the biology of depression, the biology of mood. What we think and how we think has huge impacts, not just in our emotions, but also in our physical. So a lot of times when I talk to people about, hey, you need to be on these medications or this treatment, whatever it is, not just medications, stay on the treatment, because it isn't just about your emotional health, it's about your physical. And what we're finding is that depression and those mood states can also impact other systems in our body, our immune health and our inflammatory system, most notably. The inflammatory system has been implicated in all types of disease, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, cancer, so that it stands to reason the more positive we feel, the more hopeful and optimistic we are, the better all of our lives are going to be, not just in how we feel, but also physically, emotionally, but also physically. And what this study found was both in terms of the obvious behaviors, taking care of ourselves, eating right, exercising, but also in biological markers, our blood pressure, all different types of our physical markers, those who were more hopeful and more optimistic tended to do much, much better. So they're saying if they can repeat these findings, that this really could be a huge shift in the way that we understand and try to prevent heart disease, the role of emotions. And really, I think the mind-body community is saying, well, thanks for finally figuring that out. We've been holding up our flag and signs for centuries now, but we appreciate that you've come to the party now. So it really is some interesting work that was done there. I think that was a Harvard study, if I remember correctly.
And I'm thinking of Norman Cousins many years ago, who did laughter therapy, put on
yes.
some funny movies, and he was just sitting and laughing to heal himself of spondylosis of the spine. I remember it was done years ago. It wasn't scientifically done, but he did use laughter.
Yes.
So that's keeping
and
you
that's, And that's real. It's real. That changed his physical being, and that happens, and it happens millions and millions and millions of times every single day in terms of those who take the time to be in the moment and apply some of these principles to improve not only their emotional health but their physical health as well.
Well, there was another study on your site that talks about stress and depression can lead to increased body inflammation.
Yes.
And you just said that inflammation is really harmful. So how does stress and depression do that?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it really speaks to the heart of where much of the research is going in psychiatry. And the thinking there is that there's a couple of theories that are looking at this, but when we have an inflammatory response for whatever reason in our body, many of the building blocks that go into mounting an physical response to the inflammation, so the building blocks that are needed to go and take care of the inflammation, those building blocks are also needed as blocks for some of the mood chemicals in our bodies. So when we have an inflammatory overload, it may be that because of the amount of energy that is needed to go heal what's most important right now, that inflammation, that you lose some of the level of neurochemicals that regulate your mood. And really you see that in increased incidences in depression with those that might have inflammatory bowel disorders like, say, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, and rheumatoid arthritis as well. And really
some
of the
research...
So what
I'm hearing you say is that the physical problem is leading to the emotional upset.
Yes. Yes. Where we're starting to see that is it's very realistic that for some people, perhaps with the wrong family history, with depression, it could be possible that the science is lending towards an inflammatory event at some point in one's life could be the reason that the depression is sparked. So that, again, this doesn't explain all of depression, but the science has advanced to this point that for some individuals, this may be the causative factor. And to me, it's not a surprise because we have to couch depression and emotional disorders as physical medical illnesses. And whether it's cancer or hypertension or diabetes, inflammation is an important part in that disease process. So it stands to reason that inflammation could possibly be involved with depression as well.
Yeah, so you're pointing out something that's really important, that it isn't only your mind causing physical problems or related to physical problems, it's also physical trauma can lead to certain emotions. So it's
exactly
a loop. It
the
goes
mind.
Back and forth.
That's right. It's bidirectional, mind body. You know, there is no distinguishment or distinguishing between the two. They float back and forth. Our emotions can impact the physical impacts the emotions, and back and forth and back and forth. And it's only now that we're starting to understand some of the more molecular or biological mechanisms as to why this is happening. It's fascinating research, and some of it is coming out literally in the last half year or a year or so. It's really amazing work.
Yeah, so another one of your articles talked about emotional illness is tied to higher rates of physical problems.
Yes, the higher rates of, I'm sorry,
of physical problems.
Of physical problems, yes. I'm sorry, I just didn't hear that. Yes, I mean, we see that, and on some level, certainly we understand that. I mean, people are going to be struggling. Just the fact that someone may have really bad diabetes and terrible neuropathy and foot pain or chronic pain, anyone feeling that way is going to have their emotions be challenged, and some are going to get depressed. But we're also seeing that there's an increased burden, risk, that is coming out that we're seeing that having depression or anxiety or other emotional disorders puts you at a much greater risk of having hypertension, of having diabetes, of having these other chronic medical illnesses that America faces and really the world faces. So that there really is an urgency in getting help emotionally, not just for the sake of feeling better psychologically, but from what the data and the research is showing, making sure that your emotional health is as best as it can be has huge implications on your physical illnesses as well. So again, the mind body here, and this comes up every day when people say, well, you know, why do you want me to continue with this? I mean, you know, why can't we think about something, you know, different, or I've been doing well, shouldn't I come off these meds? And I work with folks. I'm not a dictator here in our sessions. But also I want to make sure that they realize some of the implications of under-treating an emotional disorder as well.
Well, I would like to add something that you mentioned, depression and anxiety, and you did not really mention anger and rage, and those can have a huge impact on a relationship, that a couple is together and one of them, because of physical ailments like diabetes and low blood sugar, can get into rages, and it can lead to a divorce when that person really loves his partner or her partner and is just not being understood and not working through the emotions.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I didn't mean to not characterize a depression or rage. That's there and is real and has real implications. And it really just shows the complexity of not only the emotions, but also relationships and interactions, and the critical importance all of us as providers, not me just as a psychiatrist, but those who are counseling and helping, folks like yourselves who are doing the relationship and couples counseling, how important that is to help tease it out and help people make themselves aware of how these emotions are impacting, maybe without their knowledge. You know, they're just reacting. And a lot of times, as I'm sure you've seen, if you can explain that and people can begin to internalize that and understand it, their relationships get better.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So do you have some suggestions for people for overcoming stress, depression, anger, maybe eliminating chronic pain or handling it better?
Well, I think in general, with stress, listen to your body. Listen to your body emotionally. Listen to your body physically. Your body is telling you when things are right and when they're not. And I think in that, if you can lower the defenses to honestly look at one situation, your situation, and say, what is going on here? What are the things that I can change? What are the things that are absolute? Say there aren't some circumstances that I can get myself out of or change in my life. How do I reconcile that? But in that part where I can make changes, there are things that I have to consider or actions that I'd like to take, be willing to consider them and be willing to take the chance and make those changes. On a practical level, you know, mindfulness meditation, taking the time to relax, taking the time to be, whether it's a walk or whether it's relaxing or meditating, take that time for yourself, because it isn't just those few minutes that you take, but it's the larger psychology behind that that says, I matter. This is important, and I need this time. And it's important from a cognitive perspective because that respects you as an individual, and it teaches you that you can put those limits and boundaries in place. And when we start to do that and feel empowered, my goodness, I mean, people are so unbelievably strong. They're capable of so much change and positive change in their lives.
That's just beautiful. I matter. That's so,
so
easy,
I mean,
to remember. So I want to thank you so much, Dr. Zeffirides, for speaking with me today. And
sure.
I know your website is thehealthymind.com. And I hope that people will turn to your website and read some of those wonderful articles.
Well, Erica, thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the time together and the discussion. It was wonderful as well to have you on my show as well. And I just really thank you for the work that you're doing, not only the counseling, but the education and the written materials that are getting out there based on your clinical experience. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, saying goodbye for now. please visit my website, healthybabyboomersnetwork.com, to get your free report, How to Live to 100 and Beyond. Schedule a coaching or counseling appointment at drericawellness.com. You can learn about my complete relationship system at budurl.com/lovesystempreview, or find one of my Kindle books, particularly the one Your Body Believes You, because that's related to what we were just talking about on this show.